Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to a very special edition of Atlanta Business Radio. Today is Atlanta's most trusted advisors. I'm Ryan McPherson. Thank you so much for joining us. Sitting alongside me is my co-host today, Bonnie Buell-Russick. How are you, Bonnie?
I am great. How are you, Ryan?
I am great. This is episode number two, right?
Three.
Oh, that's right. I wasn't here for one of them or something. I don't know. But yeah, episode number three of Atlanta's most trusted advisors, where we feature and highlight those great individuals and organizations doing good work here in the Atlanta area. As a quick reminder, make sure you're following us on social media at Business Radio X and also now on Twitter, Atlanta Business Radio. You can find us at Atlanta Biz Radio. And Bonnie, you've got some social media handles too, right?
Oh, yeah. Everything. Just search for BBR Marketing on just about every social media platform and you'll find us.
Yeah, you'll find Bonnie and her team there at Bonnie Buell-Russick Marketing and all that. So, all right. So who do we have in studio today?
Oh, today we are going to be talking about network security and common mistakes that people make and how to avoid them with David Gracie from Network One and Carl Sigler from Trustwave Spider Labs.
All right. We look forward to talking to those guys for sure, because this is a problem that not only the one individual sole proprietor needs to know, but big corporations as well.
Oh, absolutely. It was interesting. And on the way here, or actually just right before I left, I forwarded these guys an article. Apparently, the IRS had a security breach
again
this morning. Yeah.
Didn't they just have one?
So, yeah. Yep. And so I was like, well, this is timely.
Right. Right at tax season, one of the largest, government organizations, and they are getting hacked. So what can we do as small business owners to protect ourselves and our clients? That's what we're going to be finding out here today.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
So I guess that actually does kind of lead to an intro question of, you know, what can businesses, it is a huge question, what can businesses do to kind of try and make sure that their information is as secure as possible? So I'm going to toss that out to both you guys and you kind of.
Sure. Well, first I'll say I was with Carl during the IRS hack, so I know that there was nothing that was taken. He was with me. He was not doing anything like that.
So you guys are in, we know that you're like safe. You're alibiing each other.
Yes,
out.
Right. We were getting coffee together. As a business owner myself, and we service small businesses here in Atlanta, work with small business owners, really, two areas to look at. The security 101 is, are you doing the basics? Are you making sure your computers are up to date with their patches? Every month, Microsoft comes out with new updates, making sure those are routinely updated. Make sure you've got a business class firewall in place, that you're not wide open and sharing all your data to everyone. And then thirdly, making sure you've got a good endpoint security system, like an antivirus software program running on your computer. So I'd start there. And if you're not there, those are the things you want to take care of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I completely agree with those recommendations. I mean, generally what we see when we're, doing ethical hacking and trying to break into an organization is that those basic best principles just aren't being applied. Firewalls are very important. Authentication is extremely important and often overlooked. So passwords. Mm-hmm. I would say that over 60% of the organizations that we actually breach, we get in through weak passwords. Password 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And really just by applying better, just by enforcing better passwords, more than just 8 characters, one number, one uppercase, a lot of breaches could be contained or prevented from the get-go.
Yeah.
Just recently, there was an article that came out about every year they come out with the top 10 worst passwords. And of the top 10, seven of the top 10 were some permutation of 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So it doesn't take much to change that to get, just a little bit better than everybody else in the world. So to Carl's point, just do a little bit. You don't have to do a lot, but just a little bit gets you off that top 10 list in terms of password security.
Yeah. Well, and on that note, I know a lot of us fall into the whole, okay, so maybe we have a halfway decent password, but we use the exact same password on everything just because it's easier.
Right.
I don't want to have to remember 15, 20 passwords.
Right. So yeah, what are some good ways to remember your password or store them in a safe manner when they have to be so elaborate these days?
aside from the sticky note on your monitor.
Yeah.
Another good way to store passwords, there are applications you can get for your iPhone or your computer that'll store your passwords in an encrypted file. That's probably the safest and most convenient. Carl, I'll throw it back over to you. What would you say?
No, I completely agree. Password managers are just essential in this day and age. The complexity issue is a hard one. Length is a hard one. And people just can't remember these passwords anymore. Mm-hmm. Having a password manager and preventing that reuse of passwords across multiple sites, it automates the whole process. The only caveat is that you want to make sure you get a good password manager, something that has a good reputation, a lot of other people are using. That means a lot of eyes have been on it. And you want to make sure that that master password for your password manager is extremely secure and long and safe, because that'll be the keys to the kingdom at that point.
Right. Yeah. And but then other people in the organization all have to have access to this password, perhaps, or usually is it just your one point of contact there who's in charge of your IT security?
No, generally you want to have a point password managers. You don't want to have multiple people know the same password. Password sharing is a huge issue, because if that password actually does get used in the cause of a breach, there's no liability. There's no being able to track that back to a specific person.
Mm-hmm. And it used to be that online vendors would only have a way for you to have one account for accessing their website. Then you would have to share that account ID and password among your business. Most of them have gotten better in that they actually allow individuals, and it'll be tied to your email address. So individuals would have access to that, and it protects them as well as it protects you.
Do you see passwords going away anytime soon? Whether they be going to this more of this biometric scanning or fingerprint scanning? Will we be able to implement? They're doing it for our phones now. Why can't we implement that in the big business world as well?
Yeah, biometrics, definitely, you see it in the James Bond movies. It seems really cutting edge, but regular passwords I don't see going away anytime soon. There's a lot of issues with biometrics. The big one is that, you know, if your password gets guessed or someone figures out that you use your dog for your password, you know, you can change your password for what we call two-factor authentication, where, you know, you have a token that generates a number on a regular basis, or, you know, a text to your phone. If you lose that phone or you lose that token, you can get something reissued to you. With biometrics, if somebody steals your fingerprint information, you can't really change your fingerprints. and that could be an issue with biometrics. This was actually done in Germany a little while back when they were requiring fingerprints to be associated with their passports. A German hacker actually followed, I believe it was the Minister of Defense in Germany, around until she had been at a cafe and left a glass on the table. Ah. He was able to lift the print and then publish her fingerprint in a magazine.
So sneaky.
These days with high-res cameras, you can take a photograph of a fingerprint from a distance. And even if it's just slightly legible, you can recreate that fingerprint very easy with a little bit of gelatin and some glue for the most part.
You know all the secrets, don't you?
That's insane. Wow. Yeah.
Well, I would add that no system is really foolproof. And if you're targeted, which are some of the examples that Carl's talking about, if you're a targeted person and someone wants to get your information, whether it's your fingerprint or your password or anything, there's very little you can do to stop them, because this is their world. They know it a lot better than you do, and they're going to follow you around electronically or physically and get what they need. Your goal in security is to be more secure than the rest of the guys around you. So it's kind of like the two guys who go for a walk in the woods and they come across the bear who turns and spots them, and the bear races up and he's angry, and the first guy starts to run, and the second guy says, "Wait, why are you running? Because you can't outrun a bear." And the first guy says, "I don't need to outrun the bear. I just need to outrun you." Mm-hmm. So the same thing goes. Same thing is true with security. You don't have to be Fort Knox. You don't have to build Fort Knox around your business. But you want to take care of the basics, and you want to make sure you're more secure than your neighbors. And if you're targeted, there's not a lot you can do to prevent somebody who's really focused on getting into your system to keep them out.
Well, what do you say to small businesses? Like, Mike, I'm six people. You know, we're small business sort of thing. There's really no interesting information that we have. And there's a lot of others out there that kind of I've had the conversation with. It's like, you know, who would want to hack me? Why do I have to worry about all this kind of stuff and, you know, pay for these various software programs and, you know, antivirus programs and systems and such? How do you respond to that?
I think that right there is a big issue that I see in small businesses, where they devalue the data that they actually have in-house. Nobody's wanting to steal my data. It's really not that important. Generally, a lot of breaches are just convenient, easy. They're just doing wide scans. They're not necessarily targeting you. You just got caught in the shotgun blast. And after you get infected with a piece of malware, whether you clicked on a link that you weren't supposed to click on, or you opened an email attachment that you weren't supposed to open, once the malware gets on your system, they weren't necessarily targeting you for your data. They just want another computer system that they can access and maybe use for forcing ads down to you for ad revenue, to use it for other attacks. They can use your systems to actually launch other attacks against larger organizations. So just the computer itself is enough to be a target for hacking. After that, they'll start to go through the data on that system, see if anything's valuable, see if they can parse anything. And if you process credit cards, if you have your employees' medical records anyplace, these are huge liabilities for small companies.
No, that makes sense.
Sounds like it's all defense and no offense when it comes to these cybersecurity attacks. What can you do to kind of go after them before they get to you?
It's not an easy thing, to be honest with you. We talk about offensive security a bit, and it's very rare that you see organizations do it. A lot of organizations, even probably in the late 90s, there were defenses that you could set up that would automatically, quote, hack back. If they saw an IP address hacking you, it would automatically sort of launch attacks back to sort of shut down that attack. This can be a huge issue because hackers never launch an attack from their own systems. Mm-hmm. They're going to hack into a smaller business like Bonnie was talking about and then use that as a launching point to launch their attacks. When you're hacking back, you're actually hacking Bonnie's small business,
right.
Not the actual.
Right. You're not getting the actual, you know, person behind it or what have you. So yeah, I mean, so there is no offense really. It's just build up your defense mechanisms, be hyper aware of what's out there and what's capable, because they're always going to be thinking of new ways, new methods to get to you. And you've got to just stay updated on the defensive side of things.
And the defenses are definitely getting better. And for a proactive stance, I definitely recommend that people don't just worry about preventing hacking from occurring or preventing those breaches. Also, look at the methods you use to detect if you've been breached. Security is not 100%. There's a good chance that you're going to get breached at some point in time. So how do you find that? Mm-hmm. How do you actually detect the breach that's in-house? A lot of organizations rely on what we call IDLE. That's intrusion detection by law enforcement. So until law enforcement actually discovers that you've been hacked, you don't even know it. So a lot of these organizations aren't aware until actually some law enforcement officer starts knocking on the door saying, you've been breached. It's obvious because of credit card fraud we've tracked back to your organization. It's obvious because of other attacks being launched from your networks. And they had no clue. So having those things in place to detect when you've been breached will allow you to minimize the damage and just prevent a lot of the huge, massive breaches that we've seen.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see a lot of these hacks originating from? What parts of the world more? Is it in America or is it elsewhere?
Well, there's several state sponsors of terrorism who are doing it. I mean, there's lots coming from China, lots from Iran, but then we have we have hackers as well. Israel's they're hackers. They're good guys. I mean, call them good guys, but they're employed by the government, and their job is to seek out other targets out in the world. Our CIA is doing it. And so it's kind of all over, but the folks who are targeting the small business, like Carl said, they're really looking either to access their computer hardware. So there's value in your computer that sits there when you're not using it, and they can use the CPU and the bandwidth and all that to do things. And it's a numbers game with hackers. They're, hundreds of millions of computers in the world running Windows operating systems. And so the hackers are going to use a shotgun approach, is what the word Carl described it. And they're going to, let's say only 1% of the computers that they target are going to have vulnerability they can exploit. And so that's a big number when you're talking about a scale that large. So they get a network, they control a network of computers that they control centrally. And then from that, just the massive numbers, they can either launch spam, campaigns, they can launch malware, they can do other things. They can launch what's called a denial of service attack, which is, a million computers accessing one website at one time. That can, for bad reasons, that can bring a website to a halt because it can't process that kind of transaction. And so there's a lot that the hackers can do to do that. But and they come from all over. Eastern Europe right now is a big place where that type of hacking is going on.
Yeah, and attribution is a little bit difficult too. I mean, definitely we're seeing a lot of attacks that are sourced out of Eastern Europe and Russia. Definitely a lot out of China. That's just pretty obvious. I think all the evidence shows that. But attribution to an actual actor is hard to do because, again, they're using other people's systems to launch attacks. So we see that pretty much 60% of the attacks that we see are actually coming out of the U.S. Hmm. And the primary reason is because the U.S. has such amazing bandwidth, such a massive number of internet-connected computers that they're easy to get to as a foothold and then launch attacks out from.
Right.
So tracking back the actual computer system that did the attack is different than tracking the person that was behind the keyboard.
So what do you think the odds that Hillary Clinton's email server was hacked?
People talk about the security of that, and I don't want to get into politics too much, but we just saw that, we had the huge OPM hack that occurred this past summer, the Office of Personnel Management, where, hundreds of thousands of records were breached from government systems. We just had the IRS hack that Bonnie mentioned this morning. So, whether a system is maintained privately or maintained under a government umbrella, I don't think that necessarily suggests that it's secured to any great extent. So whether her system was breached at some point in time, it's a possibility. The argument can be made that a smaller organization with a lot of resources can better secure systems because there's less complexity involved. You have a really large organization with tons of systems and a really widespread IT organization. Complexity and security really don't go hand in hand. The more complex an organization is, the harder it is to secure that organization, even though they might have more resources to toss at the problem.
Mm. Well, and these systems are designed to share data, right? I mean, that's exactly the reason we have these centralized information, is so that multiple people from different locations can access it. So determining who the good guys are and who the bad guys are is a difficult thing to do. And that's why, you need to take care of the basics.
So one of the things you guys were talking about before was, making sure you have virus software and various things in place. And our business is completely Mac-based. And I know years ago, we always heard, oh, nobody bothers with hacking Macs. You don't need to worry about your virus software or anything like that. Buy a Mac, you're safe from all this stuff. I'm assuming that is not true. Would you support or deny that?
Actually, to some extent, that is true. Still to this day, that Macs are more secure. I won't say that they're completely immune. There are definitely Mac viruses, Mac malware out there. Macs are being targeted. But again, like David said, it's a numbers game. Mac still doesn't have a huge foothold in a lot of large corporate organizations. They're still running a lot of Windows systems. So, criminals are going to run those numbers. They're going to attack the systems that are most widespread and potentially have either CPU and bandwidth or data on the system that, could be valuable to them. So a lot of malware authors out there don't focus on Mac.
Oh.
In fact, with exploit kits that we see, exploit kits are basically a network of malicious websites where once your browser hits that website, it instantly goes through exploits to breach your browser and then install malware on your system. It used to be called drive-by hacking to a certain extent. We actually see those systems filtering out Mac and Linux systems. Like, we don't even want to bother with those guys. Don't bother trying to send down malware that isn't going to infect them anyway. We'll filter them out and focus on the Windows systems that are still running XP and Internet Explorer 6. And it's an easy target.
Mm. Well, let's talk about you guys' individual businesses that you're doing. So David, you're with Network One Consulting. How long have you been around in business?
Sure. I started the company in 1998. And it was just me. I was the only employee. I had one client, and I worked out of the basement of my house. Mm-hmm. But what I did back then is exactly what we do today, which is provide outsourced IT to small Atlanta-based businesses. And most of our clients are going to be in a couple of vertical markets, either law firms, medical practices, financial services firms, real estate, construction, that type of thing. Those five make up about 80% of our clients. And really, I mean, we've grown over the years. So 17 years ago, we started, and now we have 24 full-time employees, and we manage 80 clients networks. And so, again, they're all based in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And our engineers are the ones going on site and taking care of the day-to-day issues that go on. And then we've got a support desk back here at our office that answers the phone when we have clients who have a problem.
And it sounds like those companies that you're, or those markets you're serving, the law firms, the medical practices, they have huge data that could protect and very vulnerable data that people may want. So it sounds like your level of need is even a little higher than perhaps someone who's just running a bakery or something.
Sure. Well, our knowledge needs to be. We don't keep their data, you know, on our servers, that type of thing. Our clients have their own servers that we manage. And, you know, the cloud brings an interesting twist to that. But a typical client will have a couple of servers on premise. And if it's a medical practice, they're going to have some social security numbers and obviously health information. And there are guidelines that regulate that. And we need to make sure that our clients' systems are protected. And if they have laptops that leave the office, we need to make sure that those hard drives are encrypted. Because if a physician has his laptop stolen out of his car and there's a chance that it has patient information on that laptop, then they have to report that as a security breach. And there's a protocol that the practice has to go through in order to report that. And that's all through regulations from the government.
Where do you go to stay ahead of the cutting edge of this hacking world? Is there a magazine, Hackers World, or something that you read? Or, you know, where do you go to stay updated with the latest and greatest out there?
So a lot of times the medical software vendors have trade shows. They get together and they're talking about their software and what benefits it has. And then there are also security companies that tag along with those. And how can we implement security so that the client's patient information is protected the best? So mostly going to these types of trade shows, working with the vendors to understand what kind of data is on the servers, and then obviously being experts in the Microsoft Windows world. And ensuring that we're making sure that our clients have their servers up to date and that they're protected with backup software and firewalls and so forth.
Because this is like a rolling, evolving, you know, world here. Is what's good today will not be sufficient tomorrow and beyond. So you've got to stay in tune with what's going on there, both good and bad, in the world of IT security, for sure. So, and what about you, Carl? You're with TrustWave Spider Labs. I see you're a threat intelligence manager. I've never heard that title before. What do you do?
So threat intelligence is sort of a evolving area involving discipline and security right now. Basically, what we found at TrustWave is we had a bunch of different research departments that focused on specific security areas. So we have a web server security group that just focuses on web security, web client security, so focusing on the browser side, your Internet Explorers and your Chrome and your Safari. We have an email security group. We have a database security group. And all these individual silos don't necessarily talk to each other. So my department was created to allow the research that they're doing sort of cross-pollinate the individual departments. That also gives my department a sort of broad overview of the different trends and attack statistics that are going on. So we are involved with things like vulnerability disclosure. When one of our research teams discovers new vulnerability in software that hasn't been seen before, my team coordinates the responsible disclosure where we report it to the vendor, help them develop a patch for it, and make sure that a patch is out there before the vulnerability gets discovered by the actual criminals. So, I'm sort of a traffic cop for all of the research that's being done in our group.
Right, and where do you go to, you know, what are some resources you lean on to stay informed of what's you know, the newest and greatest hacking methods out there?
There's a bunch of blogs that I follow, a bunch of online websites. Arata Security, based here in Atlanta, Rob Graham, he's a great resource. I used to work with him back in the old ISS days here in Atlanta. Generally, though, Twitter. I am on Twitter pretty much nonstop, and that's where a lot of these attacks are getting talked about. You get a lot of wannabe hackers that develop their own Twitter channels, and you can sort of follow what's going on in the underground. And you get a lot of professionals that as soon as they discover a bug, they're posting it to Twitter almost instantly.
It's real-time information.
It's real-time. It's a real-time ticker of exactly what's going on right now.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Wow, that's great. So you mentioned, David, in your conversation there a little bit about, you said something about the cloud. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk about the cloud a little bit. And actually, Carl posted something on social media that I saw today that my husband quickly reposted. So, but it basically said there is no such thing as the cloud. It's just somebody else's computer. So talk, I mean, everybody seems to think that, you know, there's this amazing magical place where information goes and it's safe and it's fabulous. And I have to say is, you know, we run our company on virtually all cloud-based software and, you know, storage and variety of things. So we absolutely love it. And it allows us flexibility that we wouldn't have otherwise. But, you know, it isn't just necessarily something you put it out there and it's amazingly safe. So when you talk to businesses, you know, what sort of advice do you give them? What sort of information do you feel is out there that may not be accurate or that business owners seem to have some misconceptions?
Right. Well, different people will probably define cloud in different ways. I would define it as essentially a server or a service that is not at your office. It's somewhere on the internet. Mm-hmm. And it can be private, which means your company owns that server and it's in a data center, or it can be more shared or public, which is you're paying a third party company to provide a service, like, you know, Google Gmail would be a cloud service in
we
simple terms. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So so I try to define it for folks in broad terms, like, hey, cloud is not mysterious. It's not magical. It's simply a computer that's not here. Secondly, we talk about cloud really at this point still being the Wild West. There are a lot of providers out there claiming to deliver cloud services, and they're not all the same. And you get wildly different pricing. And if you don't know the right questions to ask, you may end up with a system that's not redundant, not protected. There are a lot of variables to analyze when you're talking about cloud. So what we're seeing in the small business market right now is really a big trend to move email from an on-premise. Microsoft Exchange is the standard small business email service to have to move from an on-premise server to a cloud-based server. And so there are a lot of providers out there. Microsoft itself is actually in the market now. There are third-party companies that provide Microsoft Exchange as a service. AppRiver is a big one that's based out of Florida. And they provide, I don't know how many millions of mailboxes they have. But what that does is it frees up a company's cash flow because you don't pay this big investment, one-time investment every three mm-hmm. or 4 years to buy a new email server. You pay a monthly, think of it as a rental fee. You get a license for Outlook. Mm-hmm. You get the mailbox that sits on the server. That server is backed up and maintained by engineers who are specifically trained in the Microsoft Exchange world. So that's really that. What we saw, that was really the first wave of cloud migration. It was a no-brainer because as I think you ask most business owners, if they could do without their email or their phone, they would do without their phone first, because email has become so much more important as a business tool. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when I first got in this world, that wasn't the case. I mean, if email server went down for a day, it wasn't that big a deal, as long as they had their phones. You know, now it's really flipped. I think most business owners would say, you know, our email cannot be down. Well, if you have your own server on premise, you have issues like electricity goes out, your internet can go out, somebody can cut the line out if they're doing construction. There are a host of things that can, your server could get a virus or a hacker could access it and render it inoperable. The odds of any of those things happening in a good, healthy cloud environment is a lot less. So if your email server is, you know, on a run by a very first grade, a first rate system, and it's in a data center that's protected, it's got redundant internet, it's got redundant power, cooling, all those things that a system needs to run, it's gonna, the odds of it going down are a lot less.
And I would say that also we're seeing cloud a lot more because a lot of workplaces are getting so distributed now. A lot of people are working from home. They're not going to the corporate where, you know, if email goes down, you could just walk over to Joe's office and talk to him. You know, if somebody couldn't get your email, you could pick up the phone and call them. These days, I mean, I'm based here in Atlanta. My employees are based out of Chicago. My manager is in Israel, you know? So, I mean, Skype, email, things like that, they're just essential for business in this day and age. So the flexibility of having an off-premises server that is not centralized in one specific area can be really efficient for sort of the new workplace dynamics that we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're seeing, the next phase after email, what we're seeing is people are looking to virtualize applications like we were just talking about in terms of Skype. You've got, communication systems, but then you've also got your data. Your virtual desktop. So if there's a snow day in Atlanta, if it snows a half an inch, it's going to close down the city. Well, folks can work from home if they have their servers in the cloud. They can get their desktop virtually that way. They don't have to be at the office to access their data. Mm-hmm. So as workforces become more distributed, or if there's a snow day or something like that, a cloud-based server environment is a great solution to that. And small businesses are asking the questions, hey, is it right for us to move our servers to the cloud? And we're starting to get more and more of those conversations. And we have, of our 80 clients, about 12 of them have some type of private cloud solution that we deliver for our clients in a secure environment where they can get their desktops wherever they are, whether they're traveling, whether it's a snow day, at night, weekends, whatever. And it's also in a data center secured, and it's, running on really good equipment.
I would expect that percentage to go up too pretty quickly, because a lot of the businesses I know, and ours is one of them, we really do. We're very remote. I have an employee in Washington State, and even those of us that are here in Atlanta, about once or twice a week, a lot of times we'll work from home if we really need to kind of focus and hunker down and get some serious writing or various things like that done. So,
sure. It's not right for every business. There's some instances where, for instance, I can think of a medical practice that may be scanning, huge volumes of images, with it, mm-hmm. which are high-res images that the doctors need to read in order to diagnose a patient. The massive size of those files, those images, they can be a terabyte per scan. And to move that amount of data over the internet, which is what you need for cloud, is difficult to do. There's still a place for on-premise solutions. But for a typical business environment where you've got Microsoft Office running and you've got email and you need a browser and maybe some shared files going on, it's a perfect solution. It gets you out of the hardware business. You don't have to buy servers anymore. You pay a monthly bill for what you use. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of cloud.
So with all of us walking around with our laptops going back and forth from our day of working at home to our day of working at the office, that brings up all kinds of other issues in protecting the information on those laptop computers. What do you recommend to businesses to kind of make sure that that's as safe as possible, especially considering that if that information is stolen from certain businesses, you do have to publish that and, go to the press with that information. And that's the last thing you want, as a small or mid-sized business.
Encryption. Especially with laptops. I mean, what we consider the corporate perimeter has changed. We have mobile laptops. We have phones with your corporate information, really sensitive information. Any phone being used for business purposes should have encryption. Any laptop should have full disk encryption enabled. If anybody grabs that device without that person's password, and again, security of password is important, the data is complete gibberish. Nobody can access it. And talking back to cloud-based services, any sort of service like that where you're outsourcing a specific service, a lot of people are going to outsource immediately because of the efficiency, the benefits that they see, without asking the important security questions. Having a climate-controlled environment and good off-site backups and things like that are all important. But, what happens if that cloud provider gets breached? How soon will they notify you? What is their process if they get breached for notification? What is the process they have in place to detect a breach? Things like, do they provide two-factor authentication, which is essential for any sort of confidential service or a service that's going to be dealing with confidential data.
Mm-hmm.
These are questions that usually don't get asked and probably should get asked whenever you're dealing with any sort of cloud provider.
Well, that's interesting because I wouldn't think that most probably do. And you mentioned that it's kind of the Wild West out there. So using providers that have been vetted that, may in some cases be, have been around for longer, may in some cases be the larger providers. Is that important? To a small business owner to make sure that they're kind of going with the ones that have establish themselves as trusted sources?
Well, that's it's kind of a loaded question because if you don't know what questions to ask, if I'm a typical business owner, I don't know what questions to ask of my cloud provider. So I would lean on some kind of IT advisor mm-hmm. who hopefully will give me some good advice. But some basic questions to ask any cloud provider is what happens if you go out of business? What are your financials? I mean, if it's a big publicly traded company, that's a lot easier to answer than if it's a small private company. You know, we recently had a local competitor that went out of business and, you know, their clients were scrambling because they didn't know what the status of their cloud data was. And if you don't ask those questions up front, so asking about the health of the business is obviously one. What about backup? How is it backed up? And people will throw out redundancy and so forth. We'll give some examples. Okay, if I delete a file and I don't realize it for a month, what does that mean? How can I get that file back? Is it possible to get it back? What's the backup cycle, if you will? Back in the day when we had tape, it was easy to look up on the shelf and see, okay, I can go back to yesterday and to Monday and to last Friday and the last four Fridays before that. So you could spot, you know, where your data was. Cloud has changed all that. The software is extremely powerful and lets us do some really amazing things with redundancy and keeping data secure. But what about those snapshots in time? How far back can I go? Finally, you know, who's watching the ship and who's making sure things are on course? Are the servers getting updated? Is there antivirus software on these cloud servers? We want to make sure they're protected. So, you know, just some really basic things about that. And I'll go back to Carl's point about laptops for a moment, because we, you know, that's a big deal for small business owners, especially if you've got important data on your laptop. Encryption is the easiest thing to implement to protect your data. But then the other side of that coin is the data that's only residing on your laptop. How's that being backed up? Mm-hmm. A lot of folks will forget that, you know, hey, I've got this file that's really important to my business. It's sitting on my laptop. And if I lost it, that would really hurt. Well, make sure that there's something, even as basic as Carbonite. I mean, that's a $60 a year application you can install on your laptop to make sure that data is protected. But it's duplicated and put up to a secure cloud.
Yeah. And I know, too, we're probably coming close to the end of the show, but I did want to touch on Wi-Fi access, just a touch.
That's what I was just about to ask. That's a good one. Yes.
Pretty much anywhere we go nowadays, you can access free or very inexpensive Wi-Fi. But what sorts of things should you never do at Starbucks when you're using their Wi-Fi, basically?
Oh, God. Quite a bit you should not do. Those public cafes, even McDonald's is offering free Wi-Fi these days.
You can get it anywhere.
The airport, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely. And whenever you're in a public environment like that, pretty much everything is up for grabs. There are a lot of specific types of attacks, man-in-the-middle attacks, what we call evil twin attacks, where basically if I'm at a Starbucks and you normally connect up to the Starbucks Wi-Fi, I know what that network name is, I'll create a wireless access point with the exact same name. And then I'll just sit closer to your table. And then your computer, rather than connecting to Starbucks, connects to my Starbucks. And now all of your traffic is going through my phone or my tablet, and I can decrypt, read, do pretty much anything.
Right.
So think of it this way. Everything you type on your keyboard, the bad guy is going to be able to see come across his screen. So if you go to a banking website and you type your password, that information can be grabbed by the bad guy. And don't do anything where you're typing passwords on a public network like that.
Yeah, I like to work remotely. I like to go down to the local coffee shop and spend an afternoon getting things done. But I certainly know that I'm vulnerable there. But is there anything, applications you can download or other protective measures you can put in place if you're going to be using public Wi-Fi more often?
I use public Wi-Fi myself. I mean,
that's good to know. I feel safe now. Carl's doing public.
and it's a matter of understanding what the risk is versus the benefit of using that public service. I generally am not going to check my medical records at my doctor's for my recent doctor's appointment. If I'm logging into corporate email, I want to make sure I'm hooked up to the corporate VPN first. And and again, this comes back to encryption. So using things like HTTPS just as a minimum is definitely going to help you quite a bit in those public environments. If you're connecting up to your business, make sure that you're connecting up to a VPN, an encrypted channel, which can be very hard to spoof or forge from an attacker's perspective. Encryption. Just make sure that you're not accessing anything too sensitive. If you are, just take a look at your surroundings. Make sure that you kind of get a feel for the environment itself. And even just in an environment, just from physical point of view, make sure that your back's to a wall and there's nobody standing behind you, you know, shoulder surfing your passwords and things like that. So a lot of common sense things. But yeah, just be aware that if you're accessing very valuable information, be very careful of things like that in public environments.
And I'll, staying on the Wi-Fi topic, I'll shift it a little bit over to, as a business owner where I have Wi-Fi in my office, what are some things I can do to make sure that that's secure? Well, you know, the Wi-Fi signal does not stop at your walls. It continues into the parking lot. So it's very easy for somebody to pull up in a car and access your Wi-Fi signal. So there's some very basic things you can do. Number one, make sure you have a business grade Wi-Fi access point. Number two, make sure you've changed the password from the default password to something secure, and it's a little tough. And then thirdly, make sure you have separate, you know, internal employee Wi-Fi access and external guest access. So if you have people who come in the office, that guest access, it firewalls off your internal network to prevent, because, you know, if you've got a guest come into your office, you don't know what kind of virus they might have on their computer system. You don't want that to spread to your computer system. So making sure you've got a good Wi-Fi system in your office is important. And they are very inexpensive. I mean, you can get a decent, you know, Wi-Fi access point for about $100. It does all those things and does the encryption in a way that will keep your business secure.
I know there's Comcast has Xfinity Wi-Fi hotspots all over the city. I often find them, I'm sitting at a traffic light and all of a sudden I've got Wi-Fi access. And so, but I don't know if that's such a good thing, is if it, the whole city's now connected in some way.
Those, because AT&T does the same thing where they have basically either public use Wi-Fi access, or they're piggybacking on some of their customers' Wi-Fi or bandwidth. These are just rife for that evil twin attack that I was talking about. I use it all the time where I'll just set up my phone or my tablet as Xfinity or as the AT&T underscore Wi-Fi. And then I know that anybody who's set up for that is going to automatically connect to my hotspot. Mm-hmm. And then I can do whatever I want with them.
almost like without even trying.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I disable those on my personal phone.
That's good advice. That's a good practical advice that someone could use today to kind of go forward either personally or within their business. That's good. All right. And as we begin to wrap up here, let's make sure our listeners know how they can get more information about you and your service. So we'll start with you, Carl. Tell us about TrustWave and how maybe listeners can find out more information about you.
Sure. You can just go online, trustwave.com. You can also follow me specifically on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @KSigler, KSIGLER. And if anybody has any questions about our services or what we provide, we pretty much all managed services, delivery services, forensics, you name it, we pretty much do it.
Well, if you uncover some new hacking methods out there or have got some exciting new information to share, come back on Atlanta's Most Trusted Advisors and tell our listeners, because today has been very informative for myself personally, and I know our audience has found great value in you being a guest today. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. And tell listeners how they can find out more about Network One Consulting.
Sure, Ryan. And thank you for having me today. It's been a pleasure. Yeah, our website is networkoneconsulting.com, and that would be the number one. And we provide outsourced IT to small Atlanta-based businesses and primarily law firms and medical practices, firms looking to make sure their systems are secure. And that's where to find us.
All right. And are you just 24/7 IT security, or do you have some off time that you like to get away from this whole computer world? And what do you like to do?
Well, my engineers like to keep me away from all the real work done there.
Okay.
So, but our guys are, we're available 24/7. We can help out whenever our clients have problems.
Good deal. Well, thanks again for coming down here and being a guest on the program. We look forward to hearing more great things about you and your company going forward in 2016.
Thank you for having me.
And Bonnie, again, episode number 3, here we are.
Yeah.
I think this is very informative. Certainly real world practical use that people can begin to implement into their businesses beginning today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate you guys coming out. And if you're looking for any marketing services in our professional services firm, you can find us at bbrmarketing.com.
All right. Thank you so much. And listeners, if your company is out there doing something interesting to generally serve your market, your community, or your profession, reach out to us directly on the website at businessradiox.com. Thank you to Stone Payton and Lee Cantor. And on behalf of the entire Business Radio X Network, I'm Ryan McPherson. We will see you on the radio.